This is the D Word podcast, where we talk dementia. Glad to have you come there for another edition of the D Word podcast. This time, my guest is Andy Baker, a behaviour specialist, dementia trainer, and fellow podcast host. Andy, welcome to the D Word. Great to have you as my guest here. Loads of things, dementia trainer, podcast host. Before we get into all that, I mean, what fostered your interest in dementia as a subject?
So I've been in the health and social care sector for nearly 20-something years, I think it is, working in all sorts of environments and I found it fascinating every bit. My background is psychology and psychotherapy, so understanding people is my absolute passion and joy. Helping me to understand others, why they do what they do. And so part of that is understanding dementia is a whole other realm. It's trying to desperately understand a person who's changing in the way they see the world and experiencing it and processing the information puts a whole new slant on things. I also, from a personal point of view, one of my uncles who I was very close to, we had a really good relationship. I've still got a boat that he helped me build when we were young. He experienced quite a rare form, and to this day, I don't really know what it is. I don't think it was recognized, but a rare form of dementia, and his personality completely changed. And he went from this lovely, lovely man, unfortunately, to becoming a little bit dangerous to other people around him and things like that. And I always remember reflecting back on that, going, I wish I could understand more. Was it the way that his dementia was affecting him, or the way that the environment and social interaction was impacting on him? There was a big factors, and he ended up getting sectioned. Whereas my gran, who also then experienced dementia, it was some happy times in her life. As much as that sounds strange, is that we managed to get the environment right and some circumstances right, and she had a really good end of life, because she was, even though she ended up in care, it was like, oh, we've had a party today. There was like one balloon in the corner, and the children have been in, and I think one child maybe had been in with some other visitors, something like that. But she adapted really well to it and had quite a positive end. So that dichotomy between the two I found really, really fascinating. And because my specialism is behaviour, whether it be children, adults, elderly, dementia, whatever, I needed to understand as much about dementia as I possibly could to better understand certain behaviours that staff found challenging, or how to help somebody in a state of distress. So that kind of took me on that journey, really.
Yeah. Quite a journey, Andy. And as they say, if you've met one person with dementia, you've met one person with dementia. And, you know, even after 6 years of doing this show, one of the most prevalent questions I'm still asked is, what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yes, it's still, and it's strange. I don't think there's enough to support people when they're getting family members with the diagnosis and individuals with the diagnosis themselves. I often hear from family members, oh, my mum just been diagnosed with dementia. And I'll kind of go, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. I hope you're okay, and I hope she's doing okay. Do you know what sort that she's diagnosed with? Oh, just dementia. And that's about as far as they go. They don't know much more, or really that there's, you know, over, depending on which figures you read, over 200 different types. So, yeah, for those out there listening, it's the, you know, dementia is that umbrella term referring to some form of degenerative brain disease that affects a person's perception, communication, social interaction, processing, and communication skills. So, and then all of the other names like Alzheimer's and vascular and all those ribbons that hang down underneath that umbrella that covers it all. I'm sure many listeners, if they're listening regularly, Pete, will kind of know that's the case.
But, yeah, I think language is a big part of this, really, isn't it? Because, you know, we call it Lewy body dementia. We call it vascular dementia. So surely, you know, if we were going to rephrase it a little and call it Alzheimer's dementia, then maybe easier perhaps for people to understand.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. I mean, It does tend to be that just term, isn't it? That's just become synonymous. And like 60% of all dementias are Alzheimer's dementia. And therefore, because I'll start using that now, Peter. So I think it's just that's why memory loss is so synonymous with dementia as well, because it's the most common form of dementia. And yes, one of the first symptoms with Alzheimer's is memory loss. So I think what is picked up from media and media representations of those living with dementia is that Alzheimer's memory loss, and therefore people see that as a whole thing. They see the whole picture from that.
Yeah, and it's opened. I mean, I've looked at some of the training available that you do on your website, and I'm looking at that and thinking people would not link all these things together because you've got things like oral health, nutrition, distress behaviours, even dementia awareness for the church, and they're all things that people need to know about, but I still see there are a few people that are covering that kind of wide range.
It's one of the really sad things. So we've just created a fantastic partnership. So my company, Able Training, we're now in partnership with an organisation called Dementia Forward, which is a charity based in Yorkshire Way. We've also been the external training organisation of the Alzheimer's Society now for 5, 6 years. And there is so much to the subject, but it is very disappointing that many environments, especially those that are offering care to individuals living with dementia, will only potentially do a bit of an online training in dementia awareness and then send their staff off to support these individuals and look after them and meet their needs. I had a very, it was a pleasant experience in one way, but a sad moment. I delivered some training down at an NHS Trust, Dartford Hospital. And one of the nurses that came on just a 3-hour dementia awareness course, she'd been a ward sister on the dementia ward, the lead ward sister on the dementia ward for 10 years, she said. And at the end of the course, she thanked me so much because she'd learned more in the previous 3 hours than she had in 10 years on the ward. And there was an initial feeling of that pride of, well, I'm so pleased I've made an impact. But then there was this moment of absolute devastation that why didn't she already know this stuff? Why is I'm the first person that was telling her anything around sensory processing, for instance, and the differences of how individuals living with dementia can experience the world through their senses? So she'd been kind of, oh, I did wonder why they bumped into people and didn't seem to watch where they were going. And I always just tell them, mind where you're going. I'd never realized it was actually part of their condition, you know, and saying mind where you're going is like somebody, well, why don't you just remember to somebody with dementia? And I think that's where the disappointment is, that people don't, I suppose people don't know what they don't know. So they're unaware. And I don't think it's malice. I never attribute to malice what can be attributed to ignorance. But there is many homes out there, care homes, care environments, and family members, you know, not coming from a bad place, but that there is, it is a complicated disease. The human brain is the most complex structure in the known universe. And therefore, an illness that is impacting on how that works, as you said, is going to be so individualized, but also is far more complex than they just lose their memory a bit. And I think that that's where I'm doing my best to get out there and deliver the training that should be delivered. But absolutely, yeah, there's a full range of courses that we offer to try and help people with that.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
We've got some great guests lined up here on the podcast. Over the next few editions, we'll be talking about health advocacy, hearing a personal tale of vascular dementia, and finding out about Canada's first dementia village. If you've got a story to tell, then I'd love to hear from you. So do drop an email to tdwradio@gmail.com. Back now to my guest, Andy Baker. You know, when someone gets the diagnosis given the diagnosis by a doctor, a medical professional. And generally, when we get a diagnosis of something, is, oh, what can I take then? Or what can you give me? And suddenly, you're off down the medical route. And a lot of the things that you're talking about, and also the social interactions, people don't, it's got to be a busy time, isn't it? And you're listening, all this information's going in. And that's the bit you don't think of. And that's the bit where carers' information is sadly lacking.
Usually so. I think there's an underestimate as well. Like, so when you, let's say, were to get a diagnosis of any condition, especially one that potentially has a life-altering factor to it, and then some form of limitation of life based on, a terminal illness, there is going to be a trauma and a shock impact on that. Most people, when they first get that diagnosis, are not going to be ready for the information they need. They're not going to be in a state or an emotional state to be able to process that information. They're going to go through the grieving cycle, for one, where maybe there's initial denial and anger and negotiation and all those different elements of that emotional journey that anybody's going to go on with a diagnosis like this. And then suddenly a reevaluation of what their life is going to be like and figuring that out. And change is painful and terrifying at times. And I think sometimes there's sometimes maybe stuff offered immediately that people aren't ready for. But then people don't always know of how much information is out there, how much potential support could be out there for them to improve the quality of their life and end years for family as well. I think the doctors are unfortunately slightly ignorant to it as well. They don't know, again, what they don't know, and not being signposted in the right way. I think one thing should immediately be given to anybody, depending on where they are on their dementia journey. I'm never sure whether that's the right phrasing, but dementia journey is therapy. Straight away, anybody living with dementia should get access straight away to some form of talking therapy to help them to process the information and plan and talk it out and stuff like that. That's separate from their family, because so many people trying to be brave for their family, or their family are trying to be brave for them. And I think it's, especially if somebody is aware. We're doing a lot of work. I'm part of the conference that Dementia Forward are doing for young onset dementia. And imagine you're 50 years old, still working, and suddenly find out you've got this diagnosis. How life altering it'll be. Like, how am I going to take the kids to school? Because that's still within that time frame. So yeah, there should be so much more emotional and mental health support. But I think sometimes it's because it's classed as a mental health condition, but it isn't a mental health condition, it's a physical condition. But the people need additional mental health support 100% through that journey.
Also, strikes me that, where does dementia sit? Before I started doing all of this, I had a career in public health and dementia didn't really fit. I never heard it mentioned. You've just brought up the fact that, it should be within the remit of mental health, but somehow it doesn't seem to fit. And it seems to fall between both areas.
It does, yeah. And this is where sometimes I don't think people know how to support it, especially the young onset form, because it does fall under kind of elderly mental health. So those with the young onset dementia don't even have a kind of a label or a place to go. They'll end up potentially in a care home with 80-year-olds when they're still in their 50s, which I'm fine. I'm sure they're lovely people, but they may not want to listen to Vera Lynn on a Friday. So I don't know whether many 80-year-olds do, but. As far as, but I think there is this misconception that it falls very quickly into the medical model, as you said, like, either it is medicatable or it's not. But actually, as Kit Wood and the Kit Wood flower and everything around person-centered care and well-being, it's all about the kind of the social, the environmental, the mental well-being, not just the cognitive impairment. And yeah, that is still disappointing. We're a long way to go on that.
Yeah, in terms of treatments, there are social interactions, etc., that just don't seem to get the prominence. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I had Davika Wood from Brain Plus on the show, and Davika is working on bringing CST, cognitive stimulation therapy, kind of into the 21st century, I suppose, by doing it via app, which is a great thing. But part of my discussion with her, and we both thought, you know, why has nobody ever heard of this?
Yes, it was shocking, really shocking. I've got a friend and a colleague who does the training in it and stuff, and it's just, you know, it should be mandatory for anybody with the diagnosis, but it's blissfully unaware is a general consensus. And there's so much. One, it would allow opportunities for some family members to better know how to connect and support their loved one. I think so often I've seen in care environments, sometimes people not knowing how to talk to their loved one, you know, visiting, and it just being a bit of an awkwardness as far as sitting there for a bit. And, you know, the family may be feeling just a bit frustrated because mum or dad or whoever keeps repeating themselves, and therefore they get lost because they don't know how to communicate. And they could be utilizing some principles of cognitive stimulation therapy as an activity, something to do, to engage, to connect with their loved one. But it's just the information isn't out there for it.
Yeah, I think, you know, you were saying you don't know what you don't know. And I think when you're thrust into being a carer, and I think sometimes the thing with carers as well, talk to a lot of carers, a lot of people don't actually think they're carers because they're, you know, they're caring for their loved ones. Part of my job, they don't actually identify as carers.
Yeah. My mum had that, and we had I know when my mum was going through a bit of an assessment of, you know, I encouraged her to look at getting additional support and things like that as far as social services, you know, could we get some additional support for Gran? And my mum was very much of that mindset, oh, I'm not caring for her. I only go down like a couple of times a day for a couple of hours, and that's all I'm doing. So she didn't kind of see herself in that. But it was a very supportive lady, and this was maybe why I was ignorant. I hadn't come from that kind of side of things particularly. I'd worked in professional care, not within family care. But it was whoever did that sort of said, well, can you just go away without having anybody sort of take over and make sure that somebody's going down to see you, mum? What would happen if she called you in the middle of the night? Who would have to go down and stuff like that? So it was that case of, well, she's on call 24/7. So even if she's not going down and actually doing the job for the hour, she's still there. She's still making phone calls to medical appointments. She's still making sure, pre-planning things weeks ahead to make sure that, you know, my gran could get down to where she needed to be. But that wasn't picked up on. She hadn't thought of that, going, oh, yeah, that's part of the job and responsibility that I have on top of everything. So, yeah, I think there is a I think some people don't like that term as well, because it's hard transitioning from a daughter or a partner, husband, whatever, to then this new label of being a carer. And I think that's difficult for people as well, to kind of switch those roles. You know, nobody gets into a marriage wanting to be the carer for their loved one. They want to be in a marriage. So I think that's a difficult transition of admitting that shift in the relationship, I think, sometimes. But also being able to have both relationships, being a carer and still being a partner.
You explain that well. It's very difficult being a carer, being a partner or a daughter or a son or whatever. You know, the other thing is, I mean, it's the start of a whole process, because that person that you're caring for, you've also got to get into their world, and you've got to, you know, almost leave your previous world behind and go into a new world, which is, you know, frightening and very, very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, sense of identity is constantly fluctuating through our lives of who we are. You know, if you ask anybody, write down 20 phrases, terms or words of how you would label yourself. You know, that does slowly change and transition over time. You know, when you become a grandparent, suddenly that's a new label added to your list. And some people, it's what you do for a job, where you fall within your family unit. But I think when there's suddenly this hammer laid down on top of, like, this is a whole, your identity is about to change suddenly. But the identity of the person, straight away, that loss of identity is going to impact on their self-esteem and their perception and their motivations for life, which straight away has a ripple effect on everybody else around them, no matter what. And it's not a selfish thing for the person to focus on themselves, but is there enough support and resources for those who are also significantly impacted and affected by this change? Because it shouldn't be the individual living with dementia's responsibility necessarily, but there isn't anybody else to potentially support the family in that circumstance and that transition, or say that it's okay to find it hard as well. Like the feelings of guilt that so many loved ones experience, like not liking their partner on a particular day. I remember coaching my mum one time on this, where she was having a tough day. She was like, few things had gone wrong. She was stressed, she was anxious, and she was kind of going, I still need to go down and see your gran. And that's when I sort of went, you shouldn't go down and see gran. We'll sort something out, or call round, or make some adjustments. We'll go down and kind of check on her today. Because it sounds like you're stressed. So if you're really stressed and you go down and you interact with Gran today, then more than likely you'll lose your temper with her. More than likely, because you're stressed. And she'll do something to irritate you because you clash a little bit anyway. Mother-daughter kind of clash. But all that'll happen is you'll drive away from there feeling guilty and ashamed and like, what if she passes away tonight and that's the last thing I ever say to her and all of that. So it's just not worth it. Like, to keep your interactions positive, let somebody, admit you need some help occasionally, I think is a hard thing for a lot of carers.
Yeah, very, very difficult. And I think people living with dementia, I mean, I noted on your podcast some time ago, you had Pete Middleton on, who I know well, good friend. And, Pete is a great example, along with my friend Phyllis Fair, who I had the real privilege to meet when I was in Canada a couple of weeks ago, that have started with this real positive mindset. And, I don't know whether there's any medical evidence to back it up or whatever, but that positive mindset from the beginning seems to be very, very beneficial to everybody.
I mean, there is evidence to back it up when you remove it from the dementia framework, the people who see the world from a slightly more the glass is half full perspective tend to have significantly improved health outcomes across the board. Stress, we know, if you look at the adverse childhood experience studies and things like that, have this knock-on effect to a person's psychology and well-being physiologically. So this is where trauma-informed practice and things like that comes in, as far as understanding early life experiences can have a knock-on lifelong effect. But I never say it's never nature nurture, it's always a combination of the two. So in biopsychosocial model, we talk about the biological, which is the dementia, but the psychological, seeing things like, and Peter is just one of the most inspirational men that I've ever had the privilege of having a conversation with. I have a system called GPS. GPS is how I navigate life, and GPS stands for gratitude, perspective, and service. Anything good or bad that happens to me, I always try and look at it through this framework of, is there something to be grateful for this? And even if it's, I'm learning something, and Pete did that with his diagnosis of the gratitude of, hey, now I've got a purpose. I didn't know what I was going to do with my retirement, but now I've got a purpose. The perspective going, whether it be worrying about something, will this matter in 6 months' time? Put it in the grand perspective of the grand scheme of things and what other people are going through. And although this is hard for me, managing, and you have to do that yourself, other people can't tell you, to put it into perspective. And then service, and how can I take this challenge and provide it as an opportunity to improve the well-being for others? And Pete absolutely epitomized my GPS model. He was inspirational to kind of go, that's how you live it. That's it on a day-to-day. Big, big fan of Pete, and we've had some really good conversations as well. But I think that's hard, and that's where the phrase that was used for a while, living well with dementia, kind of got retracted, and people stopped using it because it was that case of, it's wonderful for people like Pete who are able to have that positive mindset towards, whether it's because he's been conditioned and grown or changed his mindset to that. But there is some people out there who, you know, we would never say they're suffering with dementia, but they might say themselves that I'm suffering dementia. It's impacting me. There's nothing to live well about here. I'm struggling on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's really important to, this is where I sometimes have the, you know, the challenge with lived experience, is that sometimes those who lived experience, not many, but some, speak like they are the voice of all. And I think it's really important that they recognize that this is my journey and this is my experience of living with dementia. Somebody else is maybe completely different. And I think it's really important to listen to those who are actually experiencing and living with it, as long as we also then recognize that, but that is, we get a cross-section as far as people's experiences. But yeah, positive mindset does improve outcomes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
The UK Health Radio Awards are back, and once again there's a dementia support category. There are five nominees, and your votes will decide the winner. So keep an eye on the website ukhealthradio.com for more details. My guest on this edition of the podcast is Andy Baker. Having a personal approach seems simple, really, doesn't it? When you just stop and think about it, but it's something we really seem still to struggle with. Because, we're all people. There's things we like. There's things we don't like. There's things we've done. There's experiences we've had. But all too often, people who are living with dementia, all that goes out of the window, and everybody just focuses on the diagnosis, which is just so wrong in my eyes. When I was working with the Alzheimer's Society, regular listeners, forgive me for doing this quick story again, but I used to meet our group members along with their loved ones or their carers. We were in church halls, so we used to meet them in the lobby. And I used to say to people, just before I kind of go in, one word we don't mention in there, by the way, and they kind of look at me, and I used to say the D word. I said, what's the point of me going in there and saying, hey, this is Dennis with dementia, this is Iris with dementia, because they're not Dennis or Iris with dementia, they're Dennis or Iris. And I kind of feel, if that message got across more fully, it would be better for everybody.
Yes. Yeah, massively. It's one thing that I kind of, when I'm teaching, obviously, my specialist area is behaviour support. I do a lot of courses around that and responding to distress behaviours. There's an activity that I often get learners to do, which is a how angry do you get questionnaire. And it's a bit of a generic questionnaire, looking at all these different scenarios. It could be like, the parking machine steals your last change, which is getting less and less relevant as we go more and more cashless. But also like, you get charged extra at a hotel for something you thought was inclusive. Somebody fails to recognise your achievements. Somebody butts into you when you're talking to a friend. And you've got this list of all these different things. And everybody either puts A, B or C. And A is, doesn't bother me. B is, that'd wind me up, annoy me, irritate me, frustrate me. Or C, that'd make me angry. And they go through these 20 different scenarios and they put A, B or C for each one. Now, there's a bit of a scoring system at the end and where they get to kind of see what scale of their anger is. And it ranges from, 90 to 100, where if anybody gets that high, we all back out the room without making eye contact. But it hasn't happened yet with anybody that high on the score. But also like 0 to 10 is also not positive. It's like, you may be appeasing people and have a lack of passion in your life, because it's important. Things are going to wind us up. Yeah, that's, we have to stand for something. The interesting thing is I try and get people to do it where I go down the list and everybody either puts whether they did A, B or C. And I point out to them that every single one in the room was different. Some people put in C to things that other people put in A. There's no universal this should make you angry. But at the end of the activity, I then go, but the people you're supporting, they could also fill in that sheet. and also be identical or different to you on all those different things. It has nothing to do with their diagnosis. And sometimes there are many homes and environments where somebody gets annoyed and they just kind of, or they get distressed and they just go, oh, that's because of their dementia. It's not, it's because you didn't do your job properly. It's nothing to do with the label. It's to do with the fact that you didn't meet expectations, or you didn't treat them kindly, or you were, you know, something wasn't right in their view of how their day should have gone. And they're perfectly entitled to that. And it doesn't, the D word, as you rightly said, doesn't, it's nothing to do with that. And that's something that happens a lot. And I do get people to really focus in that sometimes it isn't about the diagnosis, or, you know, they can't help it because we haven't done it right. It's like, you know, I have it banned. The term kicking off should be absolutely banned in all environments, apart from a football pitch. You're allowed to say it there. Because it labels a person, it labels a behaviour. And it. But I say to everybody, like, I guarantee every single one of you in the room at some point has behaved in a way that somebody else might label as you kicked off. But it's probably because they, you off, as far as they irritated you. Yeah. Exactly the same for your clients. Exactly the same for the patients, the customers, whoever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's seeing everybody as a human with frailties and everything we have all got, not taking that away with a diagnosis, which I mean, but sadly we're beginning to run out of time. One of the things I just wanted to talk to you about a little bit is that obviously we're looking at people that have had a diagnosis, but pre-diagnosis, or, you know, years before, there's a big thing about brain health as well.
Yeah.
And things that you can do, even, you know, in your teens, to, you know, cut the risks of getting dementia. I think that's a message that doesn't get across enough.
No, I think we're shifting there. There's a lot of narrative now that, you know, the perception is that dementia is an old age disease, and we're moving that towards actually it's a middle aged illness. Just some of the symptoms don't seem to present until later. With all the stuff that I do, you know, I work in foster care all the way up to elderly dementia across a full range and spectrum. And the information and stuff I found out, you know, the adverse childhood experience studies that we already mentioned, you know, children have experienced early life trauma, abuse, neglect, or negative experiences have a higher risk of then dementia long term because that stress over early life. So, but we know that we can support individuals to expand their what we call window of tolerance, their ability to cope and manage with stress using external tools. So biologically, they may be more vulnerable, but actually then psychologically and environmentally, you know, traditional martial arts is one of the ones that's measured highest, but mindfulness, yoga, therapy across the board. And this is when we're looking at, you know, the brain-body connection is absolutely massive. You know, exercise is huge, but also brain stimulus, social interaction. You know, isolation is huge for an impact factor, an increased risk factor related to dementia, for instance. So where is social opportunities and things like that? Had a group I was teaching the other day with a lady with mental health who sometimes said they were kind of being a bit derogatory that she would often visit the hospital. And it was like, she didn't really need anything. It's attention seeking. And I sort of point out, like, but isn't it sad that the only place she gets to go to feel any connection or to be recognized or to feel like she's worthwhile is a hospital? Wouldn't it be better if there's support groups and community groups and environments that she could go to and make friends and interactions? And then she wouldn't need to come to hospital because she'd be getting that need from elsewhere. But those aren't readily available. And there's a few, you know, community projects and charities that provide that, but they're few and far between and often under-resourced and over too many people wanting that particular service. So I think, yeah, people should be informed, more opportunities should be provided. We're a very reactive system. We spend most of our time fighting fires rather than putting anything in place to prevent the fires from happening across the board, particularly within medical and mental health challenges. And I think that's something that definitely needs to change. And voices like yours and like mine, hopefully over a period of time, will raise awareness. But I think, yeah, exercise, mental stimulation, social interaction, positive diets, yeah, all huge, good sleep, low stress, or knowing, good stress are all important elements to a healthy life and a long life.
Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating, Andy. I do say to everybody, have a listen to the Able to Care podcast, which you're doing, which I think is excellent. There are far too few of us doing this kind of stuff, so it's great to see somebody else producing those. As usual on the show, I have this big kind of list of why my eyes drift to the left-hand side of the screen. Must ask Andy about this, and I haven't covered hardly any of it, probably, so we'll have to get you back on the show. But for now, anyway, Andy, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for being my guest.
Absolutely fantastic. And can I just do one little plug that's not for me, but the Dementia Forward have a conference within October. I can double check on the dates. I can let you know, and so you put it in the show notes or something like that. But it's for young onset dementia up in Leeds in October. I'm going to be doing a talk there, but they've also got some amazing other guests doing talks and raising awareness, particularly for young onset dementia. So if we can do a bit of a plug for that, that'd be massively appreciated.
Excellent. Yeah, we will do. And put it out on our socials as well. So thanks, Andy. And as I say, we will speak to you again.
Perfect. Thanks, Pete. Cheers. Bye.
Thanks to Andy. And you can find out all the details about the You and Me conference at dementiaforward.co.uk. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition. Thanks for your company, and I hope you join me again soon for some more Dementia Talk right here on the D Word Podcast.